Welcome to the newest episode of Beyond the Next Chapter. As always, I'm your host, Whitney Clark. And again, I say this every single time, but this episode I'm very excited about because we get to talk about a new book that falls under my favorite genre, and that is historical fiction. So joining us today is Kate Quinn. She's a New York Times and USA Today bestselling author who, of course, writes historical fiction. She has a new book out now called The Briar Club. You may also be familiar with her other works, including The Rose Code and The Alice Network. So, Kate, thank you so much for being here.
Well, thank you so much for having me. It's such a pleasure.
Let's talk a little bit about The Briar Club. Tell folks what they can expect in your newest book.
It is, in a nutshell, the story of a very different group of women who are brought together by the fact that they all live in the same all-female boarding house in the early 1950s in Washington, D.C. And you will see how these women relate to each other as a mysterious stranger comes to rent the attic room and bring them all together in a weekly supper club where the group of strangers finally realizes that they may have a little more in common than they thought. They're also going to realize that all of them have secrets and that some of those secrets are dangerous.
And we try not to give away too much on the podcast. You know, we like to talk about the book and let people know what to expect, but like not give away any spoilers. And this isn't a spoiler because it's just in the very beginning. It does sort of revolve around a murder mystery that's unfolding in the house as well.
Yes, pretty much the very first page, you will be aware that there is a body on the floor. It is Thanksgiving of 1954, and you are not going to know for quite some time who the body is and who is responsible for putting it there in a pool of blood or what happened at that Thanksgiving, because in the next chapter, everything flips back to 4 years prior when their latest member has just come to the house and has just started to rent the room, and you just start to get to know the women involved, and you're going to get to know each of those women until by the time you do find out who the body is and what happened, you're suddenly hopefully much more invested in what has happened on that fateful Thanksgiving day.
The book is written from multiple point of views. I mean, even the house has a voice in this book. What was it like for you writing as a 13-year-old, as Pete, as Bee, as this new mom who's struggling, as Nora, as all these different voices?
I really wanted this book to be a microcosm of life in the 1950s. You know, I found it a very interesting decade because, you know, it's seen by many as, you know, idyllic or boring or repressive, depending on who you ask, as a period of peace and domesticity between these, you know, the war-driven upheavals of the 40s and then the social upheavals of the 60s. But as with most outwardly peaceful periods of history, there's a lot going on under the surface. And I really thought that I needed a real variety of women in order to bring the true variety of the 1950s and its various issues to life, which is why you have some women whose stories are very much tied up with the past, with what has happened in World War II and is still very much a hangover in the present. It is why some of them are tied up with women's issues about, you know, how women are finally, you know, trying to hang on to that Rosie the Riveter advance that they had earned during the war, but now they're being, you know, faced with the 50s ideal of the housewife and being asked to step back into the kitchen. You know, some of the women, you know, their lives deal with, you know, organized crime and the law, and, you know, how does that work in the 50s when you are a little bit ahead of the social advances that are going to be coming in the 60s. So each woman was a chance to look at a different aspect and a different issue of the things that, you know, Americans were facing in the 1950s. And I used each one as a lens in a different way. And it was a lot of fun, actually, to do that.
It was so fascinating reading about where all these different women were in their lives and the different phases of life and their ages and where they came from. What kind of research did you put into this type of book to make sure it was accurate to what was going on in the time period?
Oh, you know, it was so much research, but it was really fun. I mean, I really started in some ways with David Halberstam's wonderful book, The 50s, which just looks at the decade as a whole, you know, what's going on socially, what's going on politically, what is going on, you know, in entertainment and media. And all of those things gave me so much. I mean, during this time you have, as I said, it really is a fascinating time for all that people think it's a white picket fence era. You've got this hangover from World War II. You have America taking the lead on, you know, everything from scientific advancement to the space race, but being very backward in many other ways, since, you know, segregation and racism are still rampant. You have, you know, the anti-communist fervor is stoking up with McCarthy, which is making life dangerous for people all over America. And all of this was so fascinating that, you know, I wish, you know, some ways I could have, you know, written even more into it. But, you know, at some point you have to start dialing the research back and realize that not everything you research, no matter how fascinating, is going to be able to make it into the book.
Do you have a character or a woman in the book that you really relate to, or do you see yourself a little bit in each one of them?
I suppose I see a little bit of myself in each one of them, or sometimes not necessarily myself, but something that I would like to be, or you know, that I admire very much that I know I can't do. And for that, I did admire very much the character called B, who is an ex-player in the women's baseball leagues that we all know from all of us having watched and loved A League of Their Own. And that really came, it was something I always wanted to do because I'm a huge baseball fan. I'm not an athlete at all, but I'm a big Red Sox fan. And baseball is a language I know how to speak from that. And so I thought a woman's baseball player would be fun because, you know, those women's leagues really struggled on into the 1950s and before they folded down. And I always thought, you know, what is it like for women to have had this brief moment where they got to, you know, do this incredible thing, and then it was gone. And it was just this brief moment of time where they had an opportunity. And what is it like for the ones who then realize that they're going to have to hang up their cleats? And, you know, I liked the opportunity of being able to explore this because the end of the leagues hasn't been so much explored either in the movie League of Their Own or in the wonderful TV series that was recently done, which also takes place during the league's heyday. But, you know, it's something to, you know, I think, you know, to look at and to mourn, you know, the way that women sometimes have opportunities that arise in history, but it doesn't mean that those opportunities stay. Mm-hmm. Sometimes they leave, and then the people are left in the aftermath going, well, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. And so I really did enjoy writing these sections because, you know, I am a baseball fan. It was fun doing that part, but it was also, you know, a little bit mournful, you know, looking at a period of time that, you know, even today, women have still not gotten back to that point.
Mm-hmm. You touch on a lot of women's rights and women struggling to be mothers and also work and try to do everything and anything. Do you feel like a lot of women, contemporary women, will relate to these women, even though this was, you know, more than 50 years ago?
Oh, I think there's so much that we are still talking about today that it, you know, was still an issue in the 50s. And I don't know if it's just, you know, as a human race, we just learn slowly. And that's why the issues of the past are still with us in the present. But every woman I know is busy, and is busy on a level that would seem to be insane. You know, if there's anything I find the most unrealistic when I watch reruns of Sex and the City, it's not the fabulous apartments that these women have, you know, on apparently low salaries. It's the fact that these friends can apparently meet each other for brunch or mimosas, you know, like 3, 4, 5 times a week. You know, when I get together with my friends who are all fabulous, successful women with, you know, children, careers, many of them are writers, trying to get a group of women together in my friend group, we're all looking, it's like, well, what does your schedule look like 4 months from now? We got something then. I envy the Sex and the City women for being able to get together all the time. That's mm-hmm. what I really envy, more than, you know, the fabulous clothes or apartments even. Because it is so hard when you have women who are so busy to try to be able to, trying to juggle life and mm-hmm. family and children and work and friendships and everything else. And so that is something that, you know, I tend to think of, is that women are busy, busier than ever today. And, you know, they were trying to juggle everything back then, and I think they're still trying to juggle everything now.
I'm so glad that you brought that up, because sometimes when I watch Sex and the City, I'm like, am I a loser? Like, because I'm not meeting with my girlfriends 5 days or every, you know, it's at, like you mentioned, 5 or 6 times a week that they're meeting. So it's definitely not realistic. But what I do love about this book is the Briar Club becomes this like weekly dinner group for the women of the house. You know, Pete, the teenage boy, even like Harland, some of the boyfriends or significant others of some of the women. Have you ever had like a dinner group like this? Have you ever been part of like a group like this in your life?
No, but that's because everybody's too busy to do it every
<That's>
week. But this book really did come out of really the post-pandemic period. And I think most writers I know have what they call a pandemic book, you know, where it's the book where you poured all of your various, you know, feelings, dark as they and complicated as they were, about the pandemic and the lockdown. I think of this as my post-pandemic book because it really came out of the fact that, you know, we were just coming out of lockdown and I hadn't had a dinner with my friends in so long, and I missed it so much. You know, I would have absolutely died to be able to have my friends around one table and there'd be scraped plates and, you know, half empty bottles of wine and good conversation. And I hadn't had it in so long. And in a sense, The Briar Club is a book that came out of, you know, the fact that I missed my community and I missed my friends. And I really missed the idea of, you know, people gathering around a table and, you know, that urge that we have to feed people and to listen to them. You know, like, you want to feed them food, but you want to feed them more than food. You want to feed them, you know, friendship and advice and, you know, everything else that, you know, comes with having a community. And I often credit, you know, for this particular book, there's a great essay by the food columnist Lori Colwin called Alone in the Kitchen with an Eggplant. And she writes very amusingly, but also movingly, about, you know, being very young and very broke and living in a broom closet sized apartment in New York City. And the fact that she used to have her equally broke friends over and feed them, which, even though she had a kitchenette that was hardly more than, you know, like a mini fridge and a hot plate, and having to like do her dishes in the bathtub because she had no sink. And I just was, during the pandemic, I would read that essay and I would think, I would happily drain my spaghetti in the bathtub and do my dishes, you know, over the sink in the bathroom if I could only have my friends over. So that's one of the things that this book grew out of, was this intense desire to have my community back. And this thought that, you know, like of the idea of having people over to some tiny, you know, shoebox of a place. And even though, you know, you're all broke and you can't really afford to feed people, and, you know, the food is going to be pulled together, you know, with a Hail Mary and a prayer on a hot plate, it still can be a great dinner party. And that's sort of what this book grew out of, was the pandemic and, you know, that Lori Colwin essay, among other things.
Yeah, I love that. There's a scene that really stood out to me. It's when Nora is walking around with Javier, her lover, I guess I'll use that word. And they're talking about the Bill of Rights and the Constitution, and she's pretty optimistic about those documents and seeing those documents and preserving those documents. And he's, you know, maybe not so convinced. What do you feel, you know, hopeful about sort of the state of the world? And it seems like we're super polarized, as people were back then in the 1950s. Do you feel hopeful? What makes you, I guess, hopeful about the country and the future?
Well, this book was a lot about, you know, my own questions about what the American dream is. You know, what is it? Who is allowed to have it? And how is it achievable? You know, because, you know, being an American feels like a complicated thing right now. You know, how to take pride in our country without airbrushing away its mistakes, how to remember and acknowledge and honor our legacy while not whitewashing our past sins. And I really do believe in historical fiction is useful in presenting a warts and all approach to the past. You know, we look at the good things alongside the bad. You don't elevate the one above the other. You should learn from both. And The Briar Club, for me, it's very much a book about what it is to be an American, you know, which is something that the past decade of, you know, political upheaval and social unrest has us all pondering with sometimes what feels like increasing desperation. You know, I try to navigate toward hope myself. Sometimes that's hard, but a lot of the questions in this book, I think, are about how can you reach for hope? And in the end, it does sort of revolve around who gets to call themselves an American and who is deserving of a second chance and who gets to decide that. Is it the jury of your peers, and who are your peers? And yeah, I won't say any more because I don't want to spoil anything, yeah. But it does sort of come down to that moment.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an interest in going to see historical documents and going to see historical sites? And have you ever been to a place in Washington, D.C. that's like completely took your breath away?
I have been to D.C. and it is a lovely city, although, you know, it's very different now than it would have been in the 1950s, mm-hmm. when it was really a rather sleepy southern town and not so much, you know, the big glossy capital that it is today. I have not gone into the National Archives because, you know, I moved away by the time I had got a chance to do this book, and I'm looking forward to going to seeing that when I'm back in the area. But I do find, I remember when I went to just going and seeing the, you know, the reflecting pool and, you know, the the incredible, you know, spire of the monument, and seeing the World War II memorial, that has always moved me intensely. You know, that there are, you know, these monuments that are very much about trying to remember and trying to commemorate. And, you know, those things have moved me intensely when I've been to the Capitol.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned your husband is in the Navy. What have you learned through his career? Has that influenced your writing or your take on things?
Oh, it absolutely has. I mean, it has left me with, for one thing, you know, a sort of never ending fascination with war and how it affects both people who are involved in war, servicemen, servicewomen, but also their families. That's something I explore a bit in this book through Fliss, who is an Army wife. Mm-hmm. Her husband is a doctor. He is part of the so-called doctor draft, and he has been pulled off to Korea, you know, to work in one of the base hospitals in Japan. And that leaves her behind with a very young child. And, you know, I have been, you know, left behind a number of times on deployments. I'd never had any kind of thing the way she did, where there's only the occasional phone call and there's letters, but, you know, there's no, you know, face to face. There's certainly no Zoom. There's nothing like that. But she has a really hard time of it. And that was part of the things that I wanted to explore there, was, you know, what it is like for military families and how, you know, there's a lot of this whole thing about, oh, you know, you're serving the country, you're so great, I don't know how you do it. But there's a lot of times when, you know, you're left thinking, yeah, I don't know how I'm doing it either. Mm-hmm. You know, yeah. It's not always fun, even though it's, you know, it might be for, you know, something that has been deemed the greater good. So that has been, you know, not without its difficulties, although I will say it is not without its advantages as well, because for a lot of military wives, the problem is, you know, having to maintain any kind of career when you have to keep moving from place to place. And I'm very lucky that as a writer, my job goes with me. So at least I have not had that particular stress.
Yeah. Fliss, in the book, she really struggles with being a mom and doing it on her own while her husband is overseas, while also missing her career. Her career as a nurse and what she did before. And that's not often a perspective that gets brought up in books, because in a lot of books and movies, it's like motherhood is this rosy, perfect thing where women are so happy, they would, you know, love their kids and they're just living these perfect lives. But that's really not the case for Fliss. Why was it important for you to offer this alternative perspective that women really might relate to?
Well, most of the mothers who I know, and I'm not a mom, but I know many, it's like they have this continual struggle with always feeling like they're falling short in some area, even if they don't look like they're falling short. And social media, you know, adds to that, because so often people's pictures look perfect. You know, it's, you get that gorgeous picture of your kid on the, you know, on his first day of school, but the thing that you don't put on social media, or that they don't put on social media, is the tantrum that happened right before and right after. And the fact that you ended up being 20 minutes late and you got the side eye from the teacher, and, you know, you couldn't find the right shoes and you were left feeling like a bad mother because you did not get the organic lunch packed. It was, you know, it ended up just being a string cheese and, you know, a snack pack or something like that. And you're left feeling like you're a failure because you weren't perfect. And most of the moms I know struggle with that feeling of trying to feel, not to feel like you're failing just because you aren't perfect. And I wanted to explore that with Fliss, where she's alone. She's basically a single mother. She's worried about her husband, who she literally has not seen in a couple of years by this point. And she has a kid who's going through the terrible twos. It's a terrible age to be left by yourself. She's putting on this shell of like, everything's great, everything's fine, but underneath, you know, she's probably got postpartum. She's got, you know, tremendous, you know, exhaustion. She feels like she's failing all the time, and she has very little in the way of support. You know, she's an ocean away from her own family, and she doesn't really have anybody. And finally, you know, being able to open up a little bit to her housemates might be, you know, the saving of her, but it's been really hard. And I really wanted to show that motherhood is complicated. It's not just, you know, trying to be the perfect mom and feeling like you're failing. It's also feeling like, are you losing yourself to the identity of being a mother? Like, do you miss your work? Do you miss the things that you had before? And then do you feel guilty about the fact that you're missing those things? Because, you know, there's usually a lot of guilt involved in almost any role that a woman takes. You know, it's like, did you give up work to be a mom? Did you not give up work to be a mom? Are you balancing? Are you not balancing? someone's going to judge you. And, you know, it's that whole royal that has been a big part of, you know, the discussion nationally when it comes to women's roles. And I wanted to use Fliss to explore that, because the other thing I thought was really interesting that was coming up in the 50s was the development of the birth control pill. It was a big thing. And that's something that I tie up in Fliss's story, because she's an ex-nurse and she is aware that these trials are starting. And the 50s are known for the baby boom, but they're also known for the fact that it was starting to become part of the conversation, the idea that women could control the size of their families and more easily, the fact that they could just take a pill every day and, you know, you wouldn't have to just, you know, oh, just take what God sends, dear, you know, which is what so many of them were hearing. And so that's another part of Fliss's story, the idea that, you know, even if you love being, love your child, does that mean you want, you know, another five or six kids? It's okay to say, no, I don't want that. It's okay to say, I want to limit the size of my family. I want to have some a choice about that that my predecessors did not have.
Mm-hmm. Being a woman is complicated in 2024, and it's complicated in 1950. That was one of my big takeaways from this book, for sure.
Yeah, I think it is the complications of being female that I am always fascinated by. You know, it's one reason I'm interested in historical fiction. And it's something all my books have in common, no matter what period they're in, is that I am always interested by the ways in which women of the past find methods in which to carve out these little spheres of independence and influence for themselves when they live in eras that don't want them to have it. And I am always interested in how they do that, because in every era that you can imagine, women are doing that and they have done that. Mm-hmm. It's just how they have to do it and the ways in which they have to go about it that change.
Mm-hmm. In the book, you also include recipes. Are these real recipes? Where do these recipes come from?
Well, I wanted to include recipes just because it sort of, you know, dived in it. Tied into that whole idea of, you know, the dinner party clubs. And I thought, oh, recipes would be a fun thing to include. But also it's the fact that, you know, food and books have always been tied up together. You know, I love food in books. You know, we can all think of great foodie novels that have made our mouths water as we read. There's nothing like, you know, cozying up with a good book when you have like the perfect snack to go along with it. And also in my family, you know, food and reading has always been tied up with my husband and myself, you know, as long as I can remember, because we met back in college and my husband is a great cook. He is, you know, he is half Sicilian. His grandmother and his mother, you know, were teaching him to make a proper red sauce, you know, when he was, you know, like yay high. Mm-hmm. And he's a great cook. He's always been the cook in our family, like ever since we first got together. And ever since college, the thing that we would do together is that he would cook us dinner and then I would read aloud from some book that both of us would I knew both of us would enjoy. Generally something I'd read before and I would think, you know, like, okay, you've got to read this. You're going to love it. And I would read a book aloud. So I'm the audiobook and he's the cook in the family. And we've been doing this, you know, literally, you know, like for 20 years at this point. And so when I got a chance to do this book, I thought recipes would be a nice, you know, organic thing to include here. I asked him, it's like, okay, I have a test cook in the family. What recipes can we come up with? Can you do recipes for me? And he was just like, oh yeah, absolutely. So pretty much all the recipes in there, with only a couple of exceptions, were all test driven and developed by my husband. And they're all things that we have made, you know, Shay Quinn, while I have been reading something aloud.
Yeah, I love that. He has his own personal audiobook in the house. That's
oh, yes.
Perfect.
And a curator as well, yeah. Because, you know, I always pick the books, and with very few exceptions, everything I've picked is something he has enjoyed. We've read everything from, you know, we've read everything aloud from like Bonnie Garmus's Lessons in Chemistry, which he thought was fantastic, to, you know, Andy Weir Project Hail Mary and The Martian, which he loved. He's a big sci-fi fan. So we read it all. And he honestly doesn't have a lot of time to read fiction, but he actually gets a lot of fiction just because of our, you know, dinner habits.
Yeah, so that's so cool.
That's how he gets his fiction.
Yeah. You mentioned a couple titles. Do you have any other books that you've read recently that you really love?
I just finished up a recent release, which is The Ballad of Jacotte de la Haye by Bryony Cameron. I really love that. It is about a black female pirate in the age of piracy in Hispaniola, who is trying to, you know, carve out a captaincy for herself and also win the heart of the woman she loves. It's a great, great read for pride. And I have also been reading, I'm finally delving into a great fantasy series that's been on my TBR forever. It's N.K. Jemisin's Broken Earth trilogy. And I am just absolutely sucked in. And I don't know if I'm going to be reading anything else for a very long time. So those are the ones that I'm reading right now.
So you're talking about the Briar Club right now. I know we know that's probably the focus. How soon do you start working on your next book? I did see on Instagram that you kind of are in the stages of working on your next book.
Well, I can tell you that actually I just finished the first draft of the next
book. Oh my gosh.
And that is, I don't really have a release date for that yet because I only just finished the rough draft. So I don't know when that is going to be coming out, but it is definitely something that's going to be a bit of a departure for me. It's a little less historical, though it has to have some historical in it, and it is a bit of magic realism. So I really can't wait for that to be coming out as well because I just finished and I'm very excited about it.
In the Briar Club, it is historical fiction. Why do you think historical fiction is so popular and kind of having a moment, particularly among female readers?
Well, I think in one way it's really having a moment because it is a way for us to, you know, without, you know, a time machine, until a time machine is invented, be able to travel to the past. And for another thing too, it is a way for us to look at the parts of the past that have been left out of the broad strokes of history, specifically women's roles and the roles of people, you know, who are not, you know, white European males, which tends to be where the spotlight hits. So women's roles, you know, these women's stories, they're amazing stories from the past that we just weren't taught in school because it wasn't the main focus of the historical, you know, historical lens. But those stories are out there. They do exist. And, you know, it is certainly one of my goals is to try to bring those stories to light. And I am by far, you know, not the only one. I know so many wonderful women authors of historical fiction who share this exact same passion that I do for looking for those stories of unappreciated and, you know, unsung women from the past and bringing those stories out and shining a light on them and saying, like, let's learn about this. Why weren't we taught this in school? But let's read about it now.
We don't have much time left, but if you could relate most to one of the women in this book, who would you probably relate to the most?
Oh, goodness. Oh, that's a good question. I think I might relate to Claire, mm-hmm. who is one character who I love because she is, you know, outwardly cynical, but inward a lot softer than her outward spikiness might agree. And I do have a lot, I sometimes can be very cynical about things, but then underneath, I tend to think like, oh no, but I don't really necessarily think about that as hard-edged as I would sometimes like to be. But I love my friends and I love my people in my life the way she does, even if sometimes there's the outward urge to be, you know, a little bit side-eyed and cynical about things. And I do love that about her. And I love the fact that, you know, it allows her to hope, even in times when she knows that maybe it's not realistic. She still has a desire to hope. And that is something that I do think I have myself.
Okay. Kate, thank you so much for joining us. This was so lovely to chat with you. I feel like I could go on and on and on, but I really enjoyed this book. So fascinating. Love hearing these women's stories. So we really appreciate it. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much for having me.